Hello and welcome to book four of SAN Security 660. In this book, we will be covering exploiting Linux. So we're going to start off with a pretty heavy module, and it's called Introduction to Memory because I didn't know what else to call it. So let me explain what the module actually is. We're going to focus and take a low-level look on processor architecture and underlying internals of an operating system. So we'll get into virtual address translation, so virtual to physical memory address translation. We'll get into stack memory operations. We'll get into reverse engineering, debugging with the GNU debugger. We will look at linking and loading at the end of this module as well. So these are pretty heavy topics, and you may start to wonder, why are we going into this level of detail? And it'll all make sense as we go through exploit writing. A lot of these things we're going to talk about, if you don't have this knowledge, you are not going to know what's going on under the hood or internally. And it's really important to have this low-level detail in order to go and start writing and finding your own exploits and weaponizing those vulnerabilities. So let's get started with that section first. But after that, we'll get into shell code and how you would write shell code on Linux. We'll get into Linux stack overflows and focus primarily on getting around exploit mitigations like ASLR and data execution prevention and stack canaries and such. We'll also get into 64-bit stack exploitation as well, because there's some subtle differences between 32-bit and 64-bit. All right, so let's get going with our first module, Introduction to Memory. We already talked about the objectives, but here you have them again. We'll look at physical and virtual memory, what paging is and swapping, stack-based memory, assembly language, and linking and loading. So physical memory, what we typically think of when you hear the term physical memory is RAM, right? Random access memory. And we all like to have 32 or 64 plus gigs of RAM in our system because we can run a lot more processes at once and help speed up our system. But from the processor's perspective, where does RAM sit? On the processor itself, integrated in, are these processor registers. And each core of a processor would have a set of these registers. Now, it says hard-coded variables. That may be a little bit misleading. What is meant by that is that they're integrated in, and you can't typically directly manipulate them unless you're using an opcode or instruction specific to that architecture to make changes or to redirect the execution and such. So that's what we'll get into with this low-level introduction. But they're integrated in, and there's only so many of them, and each core has a set of them. And we're going to go and cover each one of them coming up here shortly. So again, we're just introducing them at this point. Now, since they're integrated into the core of the processor, each core, they're extremely fast. So where do they get their information from? Again, we use instructions and opcodes to be able to manipulate them, but they typically get their information from processor cache. So you've probably heard of L1 and L2 and beyond cache, and there's different types of caches. There's data cache, instruction cache, where instructions would be fetched. There is something called translation look-aside buffers, which I'll explain a little bit more about here soon. But the processors get their information from these caches, and then the caches get their information moving outward. So outward we go from L1 cache to L2, L2 to L3 if it exists, all the way out to RAM. So we eventually get to RAM. So from the processor core perspective, that's out a ways, right? It's out a bit from the processor itself. And then of course we could page things out to swap space on disk. So on the top there, you see general purpose registers 32-bit, and then below that 64-bit. The E on the front of the 32-bit register stands for extended, and the R on the front of the 64-bit register stands for register. Now, before there was extended AX and extended BX, it was just AX and BX, and that would be 16-bit architecture. Now, you will still see references to different subsets of these registers when you look at the disassembly of a process, and this will become more clear as we go through it. But my point being, so EAX stands for Extended Accumulator Register. That is a 32-bit register. RAX stands for Register accumulator register. And it sounds strange, but that's what it stands for. Even though we might be on 64-bit architecture, you will still see instructions referencing EAX or even AX or lower. And you'll see why that is the case as we go through it. But just know that on 32-bit, there are 8 general purpose registers up there on the top of the screen or in the slide. And then there are 16 general purpose register on 64-bit. So we've got those same initial 8 general purpose registers, but then we also have register 8 through register 15. So why did they add 8 additional registers? One example or one reason would be on 32-bit processes, oftentimes we will pass arguments to a function call via the stack. So we'll actually push these arguments onto stack-based memory before we call a function. And that means that they may be in a potentially writable or overwritable location. If an attacker can find some kind of an overflow condition, they might be able to modify what those arguments are supposed to be, which could allow them to take control of the process. So on 64-bit, one of the reasons why they added an additional 8 registers is so that we can pop or put the arguments into the registers themselves and pass them as arguments from that position. That makes it more difficult for an attacker to be able to manipulate the arguments since they're in a register and they're not sitting there on the stack. But we'll cover more information on this as we go through. Segment registers, there are 6 of them. They had more of a purpose historically. They're, again, only 16 bits, so they're not capable of holding a full 32 or 64-bit virtual memory address. So they would typically point to offsets to different locations, like CS stands for code segment register, and DS stands for data segment register. SS is stack segment register, ES is extra segment register, FS and GS don't have a definition, but they can be used for multiple purposes. Again, historically, they had more of a purpose. On modern operating systems, they have some specific purpose, like, for example, on Windows, the FS segment register, while in user mode, always points to the thread information block. The GS segment register in user mode might point to something else. We'll get to this stuff when appropriate. So the flags register, this is an important register that stores oftentimes the result of mathematical operations. In other words, if we do something like a string comparison, where we compare 2 strings, and if those 2 strings are equal, we might set a specific flag called the zero flag. If there is a negative integer being utilized, maybe we set the negative flag. Or maybe we're doing a Boolean operation such as a AND or an OR, and we have to carry the value, so we might set the carry flag. So you will see this as we go throughout the remainder of the course, when appropriate or when applicable, that the result of some type of arithmetic or comparison in memory or in the process will result in these bit values in the flags register being set accordingly. And then when you get to an edge and a block of code within a function and it says something like jump if not equal to 0, that decision is going to be based on what a specific flag in the flags register is set to. And you'll see tons of examples of this as we go through. The instruction pointer is the coveted instruction pointer, where that is pointing to the next virtual memory address where code execution is to occur. So if we're working our way down through a function, the instruction pointer is what's pointing to the next memory address where code execution will continue. So the instruction pointer doesn't execute the code. The processor does that. The instruction pointer points to the next memory address where code execution will occur. So if we can, from an attack perspective, get a hold or get control of the instruction pointer, we can tell it where to go and we gain code execution. The control registers, not typically too important for our purposes or our purpose, but there are typically 5 control registers, 0 through 4. And I'll give you a couple examples. One, as you see on the slide, control register 3 holds the start address of the page directory. So let's say you're in a 32-bit process and you've context switched to the notepad process. When that occurs, the control register 3 is going to point to the start address of the page directory specific to that process. And this is really important for virtual to physical memory address translation. And I'm going to draw this out in a couple of slides here. So I'm going to draw on the screen and you'll be able to see what I mean by this virtual to physical memory address translation and where the page directory falls in. Another example of a control register that I'll explain is when you're in kernel mode context, so in ring zero context, one of these control registers, there was a bit that specified whether or not a control called supervisor mode execution prevention, so SMEP is what it's called, supervisor mode execution prevention, whether or not that's set depends on a bit that was pointed to or held in a control register. So just some examples there. So let's go into more detail with each one of these registers. So AX stands for accumulator register, and it applies to both EAX or RAX, but I don't want to have to spell all of those out. So if I say AX, it applies to both unless I note an exception. So the accumulator register is seen as the primary calculator for the processor core. You see an example of an assembly instruction on the right. We I multiply 4 next to what's stored in EAX, and that's going to be AT&T syntax there. We'll talk about the disassembly syntax and flavors that we have when appropriate, but that's just an example of a AT&T syntax. Either way, calculations that are occurring, maths that are occurring, is going to oftentimes be done utilizing the accumulator register. It also, you'll see a lot of times, let's say we do a heap alloc call. So we want to allocate memory on the heap. The return from that call, so if we request 100 bytes of memory to be allocated on the heap, the return back will often be in the accumulator register. So if you look at the accumulator register, when a return from a heap alloc call occurs, it should be a pointer to the memory that was just allocated. So oftentimes the accumulator register is used to return a value associated with a function call. So DX is data register. It's more of a general purpose register. Now, you have to imagine, if you're writing in a high-level language like C#, and you are compiling that code, a lot of times it's going to be compiled into like an intermediate language, so MSIL, for example, and then that's going to make it more universal or portable amongst different systems. And then when you execute the code and run that program, that's a C#.NET, for example, it's going to continue to get compiled, right, at that point, just in time, and it's then going to be put into the opcodes that the processor is going to execute. Now, that's a high-level language, and the compiler is making the decision as to how the code will end up. And it's a bit abstract because what I'm trying to say is you don't have as much control in a high level language as to how your code will be compiled as you do in a low level language like C or assembly. If you write code in assembly, you can choose whatever instructions you want, whatever opcodes you want, and you can tell these registers to do exactly what you want them to do, and you can use them accordingly. So a lot more low-level control in a low-level language versus a high-level language where that's being taken away from you. You're not responsible for that. So the compiler is going to make those decisions on your behalf, and you have to hope it's making the right decisions. So that's a long-winded way of saying you never quite know exactly how the registers will be used because the compiler and the assembler is making those decisions for you unless you go low level, which is a great thing about languages like C where you can put inline assembly and you can make them do things a way that the compiler may not have chosen, which is great. But also with low level languages, you get yourself into more trouble because you have that power that you don't have in the high level languages. That's why languages like Go and Rust are high level languages, but they're trying to give you low level power and removing some of that safety concerns that you would have typically with a low level language. So pretty neat languages. I do think languages like Rust and Go are definitely the future because we do need to take away some of that power from these low-level languages because of all the issues we've seen come out over the years. You know, all these low-level vulnerabilities like stack overflows and heap overflows and use after free and type confusion are a result of these powerful, fast, low-level languages. And if done well, obviously they can be just as safe, but it's putting a lot more of that burden on the developer. So again, data register, it depends on what the compiler wants to do with it. It could, on 32-bit, work with the accumulated register on calculations, because it doesn't have as many bits in play as 64-bit does. You might be in the middle of a driver request being made, so some type of IRP packet, and the DX register might point to a input or an output buffer. So it all depends on how it's compiled. CX is a count register. It doesn't have to be used this way, but commonly you would see it. Let's say there's a loop operation occurring. So we say something like increment I until we hit 10. So I is often used as a counter, right? A variable for a counter. Well, you might see that the CX register is what is holding that counter, that iterator. The BX register is truly a general purpose register. So think of it like you open up a cabinet or a closet in your kitchen, and you've got all these shelves. The things that you're more commonly going to use, you're going to put on a lower shelf that's more easily accessible, right? But you do have this extra space up high, and you can store things up there as well. That's what I would consider like BX, an analogy of what BX register is. It's just more space. Just like in 64-bit with R8 through R15, it's extra space, and you can use it for whatever you want or whatever the compiler chooses to use it for. Another note there at the bottom, and you'll see a diagram coming up in a couple slides, the registers can be broken up into smaller pieces, not in any way you see fit, but in a specific way. For example, if you've got the RAX register, that's 64-bit register. You can take the lower 32 bits by just referencing EAX. So even though it's a 64-bit process, you could still say EAX, and it's only going to grab the lower 4 bytes. You could also go further than that and say AX, and that's going to grab the lower 2 bytes, so 16 bits. You could say AL, which stands for accumulator low. That will grab the lowest byte in the 64-bit register alone. Or you could say AH. That will grab the second lowest byte in the 64-bit register. So again, you can access, moving to the right, subsets of this overall register. You can't say, I only want to grab the most significant byte of a 64-bit register. You'd have to use a shift instruction to do that. But you'll see a diagram coming up soon. The SI and DI registers are the source and destination index registers. Note the assembly instruction at the top there. It says, repeat until zero, compare the string one byte at a time, and then we've got EDI and ESI. Now, those parentheses around EDI and ESI means it's a pointer. That means don't compare what's stored in the registers, compare what they are pointing to each other. And in this case, it'd be a string compare operation. We'd be going to the address held in the destination index register, going to the address held in the source index register, and comparing the strings stored at those addresses to see if they're equal. If they're equal, we would set the zero flag to a one to indicate that they were equal. If they're not equal, we would set the zero flag to a zero. And then the next instruction may likely say something like jump if not equal to zero. And that decision to jump or not is based on whether or not the string comparison was true or false. So SP and BP, it's that these are historically the stack pointers. So ESP or RSP, that's the stack pointer. It always points to the top of the current stack frame. And we'll talk about what a stack frame is soon. The BP is the base pointer. Now on 32-bit and sometimes on 64-bit, the base pointer points to something called a frame pointer or saved frame pointer. And I'm going to walk through this soon when we go through stack operation. Now, I just want to explain, though, why it's more significant on 32-bit. Because on 32-bit, we typically always pass arguments on the stack, as I mentioned previously. So if we call a function and that function is supposed to add two numbers together. Well, maybe I pass those two numbers to add together as arguments prior to calling this calculator function. And it's going to need to know where to find those two arguments. And it does that by referencing the base pointer because it's a static position throughout the lifetime of that function call. And I'll draw this out very soon. On 64-bit, we may be passing those arguments via registers. So therefore, the significance of having a register that points to a static position throughout the lifetime of a function call is not as important or necessary. And you'll see differences as we go throughout the material. This right here is that diagram I just referenced, showing you that you can access smaller portions of certain registers. Notice that we can only do it with EAX, ECX, EDX, or EBX. And that applies also to RAX, RCX, RDX, and RBX. We can go and grab subsets moving to the right of each of those registers. We talked a bit about this already, and I don't want to spend too much time here because it's not really important. The segment registers, historically, with 16-bit architecture, had a lot more meaning, a lot more use, and sometimes on 32-bit, depending on the operating system. That's one thing we're pointing out. We're focusing on Linux with this book, but a lot of these things apply to different operating systems, and there are hundreds of operating systems, so there's not any global rule that any of these operating systems have to use this technology in any specific way. There are some similarities, but there are also a lot of differences. So a segment register, it's not capable of holding a 32 or 64-bit address because it's only 16 bits. So the first 13 bits of this register would be an index or offset into a descriptor table, like a global or local descriptor table. And what it's going to allow it to do is resolve its full linear address, whatever that may be. Now, commonly we see these segment registers pointing to a offset to a structure in memory that's needed. And an example I gave previously, like on this slide, it says notable use with Windows for FS. While in user mode, under the context of a process, each thread gets its own thread information block. And it's a little structure that stores information that's needed by the thread. Well, no matter what thread you are under the context for, it's the FS segment register is going to point to that thread's TIB, that thread's thread information block. And that's just with Windows, though. Right? Linux doesn't have something called a TIB. But then when you go into kernel mode, there is no TIB in kernel mode. There is no process environment block in kernel mode. Those things are called like eProcess and eThread. I just wanted to point out that these segment registers may or may not have any use depending on the architecture you are working with. Memory models, this is another spot where we don't really need to concern ourselves with it so much, but I want to kind of point out from a high level what it is. Most operating systems, when you boot them up, start off in something called real mode. It's maintained for backward compatibility. It's very limited. Even 64-bit will start off in real mode. But then they will quickly convert into protected mode for 32-bit or long mode for 64-bit. It's a bad analogy, but it kind of works, which is think about Windows file system format like NTFS versus FAT. We all know that FAT is flat and it doesn't support any permissions and compression, and it's not security oriented. People would say, no, use NTFS because it does support all that security we want. It's similar here where real mode is kind of flat, doesn't support like ring segmentation in the same way that protected or long mode does. So we want to move into those modes, and those are what are used. So virtual memory, these slides, so this slide and this slide on paging and this slide on paging versus swap, these all kind of blend together, and I'm going to take this time to draw out kind of how it all works. The question we're trying to answer is, how do we move from virtual to physical memory? In other words, if you go and use a debugger and you debug a process, that's virtual memory you're looking at. Every process gets its own set of virtual memory. In 32-bit world, it's 4 gigs of virtual memory per process. On 64-bit, it's 7 to 8 terabytes of virtual memory per process. So if we've got 10 64-bit processes running, that's theoretically 80 terabytes of memory. I don't have 80 terabytes of RAM on my system. That's not possible, right? but it doesn't have to be. It's virtual. We only use what we need to use. But that address space is available to every single process. But every process has its own isolated page directory, you can say. So that's what I want to draw out. We're trying to understand how we get from virtual to where on physical memory and RAM that variable is actually stored. And as you see here, before I start drawing, paging and swapping, when you think historically, swap was when we would take a whole process and we would swap it out to swap space on the hard drive. So there's a special area on the hard drive reserved for swap, and we could pull things from RAM and move them over there. And that's because RAM was limited, especially many years ago. Nowadays, we typically don't have to swap a whole process out of memory, but we may page things out to disk if we have swap supported. Maybe a process is eating up a bit too much RAM and we need to make space. So we page out to swap space some portion of that memory that's not commonly used. But then if we go and access that memory addressing that's been paged out to swap, then we hit a page fault. So remember earlier I mentioned control register 3, and CR3 points to the start address of the page directory for each process. So when you context switch to a particular process, that means the processor is focusing on that one process right now. So the control register for that process points to the page directory, which is going to help us translate virtual to physical memory. And that's what I'm going to draw out. Each page directory can hold up to 1,024 page tables. Each page table can hold up to 1,024 page table entries. So let's do a little bit of drawing here. So I'm going to narrate as I'm going. And you know, when I teach this class live, sometimes people say, well, why don't you put this drawing in the book? And the answer is because it doesn't work as a completed drawing. It works as a drawing in progress, like when we build it, so I can narrate what's happening in each step. So let's first draw three processes. So I've got one there, and then I'll make them all the same size. Let me just copy and paste them. There's process, we'll call that one 20, and process 30. So I've got three processes, and just imagine these are the PID numbers up top, 10, 20, and 30. So we split them all down the middle because a portion of this is going to be for kernel space and a portion is for user mode. And let's just use Windows as an example. If it's Windows and it's a 32-bit process, 2 gigs of the virtual memory goes to the kernel up top and 2 gigs goes to user land at the bottom. And since we're 32-bit, we'll say 0x0, that's the very bottom memory address in user land, and that's going to work its way up to the top of user land on a user mode process would be 0x7FFFFFFF. Now you can't actually, or user mode can't actually access that. That's kind of like the border or the page between user mode and kernel mode memory, but that's still technically in user mode space. Then in kernel mode space, we start off with 0x8000000, and we go all the way up to 0xFFFFFFFF. So that would define 2^32 power, which is 4 gigs. That's 32-bit memory space. I don't want to draw 64-bit out because that's going all the way up to like 7 or 8 terabytes per user mode and kernel mode. What's important to understand though is this memory in kernel mode is monolithic. And by that, I mean it's shared. So if you went to process 10, 20, or 30 and you had a kernel mode debugger and you looked at the kernel mode addressing, what's stored in the kernel mode addressing in process ID 10 is going to be the same for 20, same for 30. And that's okay because that's the kernel space. That's ring zero. The user mode process cannot access that. If you were using Immunity debugger or x86 or x64 debugger or Ollie debug, you can't see kernel memory. You have to use WinDebug if you're on Windows. So the process can't see it. In order to get to that memory space, you've got to make a syscall into kernel mode, and then you're in ring zero or supervisor mode. So that's monolithic between all the processes. But in user land space, every process has its own, in this example, 2 gigs of virtual memory that's per process. And what I mean by that is, let's take an example. Let's say that this little dot here I'm drawing in the bottom corner of each process and user mode is a memory address. And that memory address is, let's say, 02000004. And that's going to be the same in the other two processes. So I'm going to grab that and paste it. So that same virtual address has different things stored per process. So let's say that PID number 10 is the calc program, PID number 20 is paint, and PID 30 is notepad, all the classic Microsoft applications. And in PID 10, at that memory address, 02000004, is the number 88. In paint, in PID 20, there's some pixel value. I'll just put pixel. And in notepad, in PID 30, at that address is the string banana. Now, that's important to point this out because we're talking about three processes running at the same time at the same virtual memory address, but three different things being stored at the same place at the same time. How is that possible? It's possible because it's virtual memory and every process gets its own 2 gigs of virtual memory for user mode in this example. Those user mode or virtual addresses translate over to different physical addresses based on the page directory and the translation that we're going to walk through. So I'm going to draw a little CPU down here in the middle. Just put CPU. We'll pretend it's a single core CPU. And that CPU has its own set of registers. So we'd have the instruction pointer. We'd have the stack pointer, the DX register, the SI register, so on and so forth. And each one of those holds a different value in them. So the IP is going to point to some memory address. I'll just make this up and say 7FFD0480. That's where the instruction pointer is currently pointing for the calc process because we're currently under calc's context. The stack pointer points to something else, something else, something else. So again, the processor is currently under the context of the calc process, which is PID number 10. So the virtual memory addressing that you see in the registers is relative to that process. So how do we then do the translation to physical memory? Well, we talked about the control register 3 pointing to the page directory for this specific process while we're under the context of this process. Each page directory can hold up to 1,024 page tables. So we'd have 0, 1, 2, dot, 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 dot. Each page table can hold up to 1,024 page table entries. And we'd have 0, 1, 2, 3, dot, dot, dot. Now, when we're doing this translation from virtual memory to physical memory, the virtual memory address is 02000004. A portion of that is going to index into a page table offset, and the remaining portion of that is going to index into a specific page table entry, which is going to point to the actual RAM address where this variable is stored. So the number 88 is stored to that offset in physical memory, and that's the translation process. Once we go through that, we would put that entry into something called a translation look-aside buffer. So that way we don't have to do this exhaustive lookup like we just did. Once we context switch though from PID number 10 to PID number 20, then those TLBs get flushed. And what we need to do is take the state of the process. So all those processor registers, which are holding virtual memory addresses specific to the calc process, we need to take a snapshot of those and we store those into something called the processor control block, the PCB. And each process is going to have a PCB. So that when we take a snapshot for PID 10 and we put it in the PCB, we then context switch. So we then will leave PID number 10 and the CPU is going to go and move over to say PID number 20. And now we're going to take the PCB for paint and we're going to populate the registers with those, that information, and we can continue where we left off the last time we were under the context of paint. So that's how that works at a pretty low level. It's, you know, it's pretty fascinating as to what's going on under the hood and how fast these processors are, because they're moving around constantly between the different processes. And when you hit a key on a keyboard, you're causing an interrupt. When a packet shows up, it's going to cause an interrupt. And the processor is doing so many things at once. So let's go back to the slide, but that is pretty much how virtual to physical address translation works, at least to the level that we need to understand it. So moving onward, object files, just like a file format like PDF documents or a bitmap document, that those are file formats, right? And the a process or an application that's parsing through a PDF document knows that it's a valid PDF document. How? It's because there's magic numbers in there, there's metadata that it's looking for, and there are these, again, parsers that are going through these validation routines that are going to make sure that the document is in correct format. I'm sure you've opened something up before and it says, this program doesn't understand the file format you're trying to open, or it looks corrupt. And that's because the validation routines aren't getting what they expect to see. So just like file formats have a format associated with them, so do binaries. So your object files, so your ELF files in Linux or your PECOF files on Windows, they have their own specific file format, and the compiler is going to compile them into this file format. Some examples of segments inside the object file format is the code segment, where executable code is stored, a data segment. So to give you an example, if we call printf, well, printf is a function, print formatted, and we expect it to print something out to the screen. Well, that's going to be executable code, but what it's printing out to the screen, like please enter an integer, that's going to be stored in the data segment. So it's an initialized variable, it's the initialized data that'll be used when appropriate. So the code segment's fixed size, it needs to be executable, but should not be writable. The data segment should not, and nothing else should be executable except for the code segment. And that's where controls like dep come in, or WX or X in Linux. It's enforcing per page, saying this page is marked as executable, therefore it shouldn't be writable. And this page is marked as writable, so it shouldn't be executable. Now we can utilize functions, of course, to change permissions in memory, but that's kind of how it works from a high level. So fixed size. The BSS segment, block started by symbol segment, stores certain types of variables that are uninitialized. So if I say in C, int x equals 1, semicolon, that means I've initialized x to 1. So it's an initialized variable. If I say int x, semicolon, but I don't initialize it, then it might be stored in the BSS segment, and it will later at runtime be initialized. Then we have the heap segment, which is a dynamic area of memory. And I'll give you an example of where that's used. We used to have a module in this day on the heap, the Linux heap, but we didn't do any heap exploitation due to time constraints. And I decided to pull that module out because we don't do heap exploitation. We just don't have the time for it. It's very complex. We do that in 760. But also I replaced it with a module, an exercise on 64-bit exploitation, which I thought was more important for this course. So let me just give you an example of the heap. The heap, if you open up a browser like Chrome and you've got multiple windows open and you're on Facebook in one window and you have a PDF document opened up on another window, that PDF document, when you open it, is going to result in heap allocation. So memory to be allocated on the heap, so that it can store the contents of the PDF document that you're viewing on the screen. And it needs to be stored in dynamic memory because the developers of Chrome, they have no idea how long you're going to be viewing that document. It's not like the stack where when we do a function call, we have a temporary stack frame, an allocation in the stack memory created until that function is completed, until it's finished. When we return from that function and we're done executing the code in that function, that stack-based memory that was used for the function call is dynamically torn down via something called the procedure epilogue, and the compiler inserts that code. So it's automatic cleanup. On the heap, we don't have that because, again, it's not finite. A function call is finite, an allocation on the heap where you're viewing a PDF document in a browser, it's going to stay resident until you close the browser or you go to a different URL and it frees up that memory. So it's heap is used for dynamic memory allocations and it needs space to grow. So you can't constrain it because again, the browser can't say you've taken up too much memory. You have to close some window or you have to move to a different URL to free up memory before you can use any other memory. So it needs to be dynamic and have a lot of space to grow. The stack segment is used for, again, function calls. Every function call gets a stack frame associated with it that's dynamically created by compiler inserted code. And we're going to cover this in the next set of slides, exactly how the stack segment works. There are additional sections in memory. Examples would be like the relocation section, the imports tables, or the procedure linkage table, and those are all part of the object file as well, but we'll get to that when appropriate. So let's go through stack operation, and we're going to walk through a function call being made and what that looks like in memory here. So on the left, we've got the code segment, and we've got two functions, at least a fragment of two functions. We've got the main function, and we've got a function called funcx. So that would be in the code segment. This would be executable memory. And you can see the memory address to the right and to the left. And to the right of that, you see the actual instruction. And the top one says move EAX EDI. So that's where we're going to start here in a moment. But that's executable code. Over on the right of the screen, you see the stack segment. This is a completely different location in virtual memory per process used for stack operation. That's going to be a writable area of memory, so it shouldn't be executable because controls like dep should be protecting us, but we'll get back to that soon. And you can see a couple of those registers we talked about, the stack pointer and the base pointer. So this is what we're going to walk through. We're going to walk through a function call and how that results in stack allocation. So let's start with this first screen here that we're already on. IP on the left stands for instruction pointer, and the instruction pointer is pointing to the next virtual memory address where code execution is to occur. The address where the instruction pointer is pointing is 804.8202, and the instruction at that location is move EIX into EDI. Now, what you see on the screen here is AT&T syntax, and I leave it to this default here only because the default with the GNU debugger that we're going to use is AT&T disassembly syntax. And we'll look at the two different flavors of syntax coming up in a bit, but just know that this is AT&T syntax. And what that instruction is saying is move the contents of EAX into EDI. It's not actually moving it out of the register and into the other register, it's just copying. So think of the move instruction as we're copying the data from that first register into the second register. And the result of that would be both of those registers hold the same value. And that's all we've done in that first example. Nothing, no changes to the stack will have occurred. Then we move to the next instruction and we say push EDI. There are three very powerful stack-based instructions. And that's pop, push, and ret. And you'll see all three of these being used in our walkthrough here. The push instruction says, push whatever we're telling you to push. In this case, it's the contents of the EDI register onto the stack. So look at the slide before. That's where the stack pointer points currently. It's the top of the main stack frame. But when we execute the push instruction, we've actually moved the stack pointer up. And now it's pointing to the contents of the EDI register that was pushed onto the stack. And notice that arrow on the far right that points up because the stack grows from high memory towards lower memory. And we'll get back to that soon. But all we've done so far is we've copied the contents of EAX into EDI, and we've now pushed the contents of EDI onto the stack. So the stack pointer therefore adjusted accordingly. Next up, we've got a call to function X. The call instruction is going to do two things. The first thing it's going to do is it's going to redirect execution to a different location within the code segment where function X resides. So it's redirecting code execution. The other thing the call instruction does is look at the memory address on the left below the call to function X. That will become what's called the return pointer. The call instruction is going to take that virtual memory address and it's going to push it onto the stack, and the stack pointer is going to adjust and point to that accordingly. So the call instruction did two things. It pushed that return pointer onto the stack, and it's going to redirect code execution to the function we are calling. That return pointer is important because once we're done executing the code in function X, we want to return control to the caller, and that return pointer is how we get back home. So now that we've called function X, the instruction pointer jumps over to function X. The stack pointer was pointing to the return pointer, and we're going to hit something now called the procedure prologue. The procedure prologue and epilogue is compiler inserted code that sets up the stack frame first, and then it tears down the stack frame once we execute the code in the called function. So the first instruction that's part of the procedure prologue is push EBP in this 32-bit example. So look at the base pointer on the screen. It's pointing down somewhere in the main stack frame. We are taking the address held in the base pointer and we're pushing it onto the stack. And that's resulting in the stack pointer adjusting accordingly up 4 more bytes in this case to point to the saved frame pointer. Just like the return pointer is used to return control back to the caller in regard to the instruction pointer, the save frame pointer is used to restore the base pointer back to where it was pointing prior to this function call, because we're about to move it. The base pointer points to a static position for the duration of a function call. Right now, since we've called a new function, we're going to move it so it points to the static position in the newly called function. The next instruction here is copy or move the address held in the stack pointer into the base pointer. So now you see that the base pointer and the stack pointer both point to the saved frame pointer. The base pointer will stay pointing here for the duration of this function call. Why? Because remember earlier on, the first thing or second thing we did was we pushed EDI. Since the base pointer is now going to point to the saved frame pointer, if we say base pointer plus 4, it's going to point to the return pointer, right? And if we say base pointer plus 8, it's going to point to the argument, which was the contents of the EDI register that we pushed onto the stack. So if we say go and grab EBP plus 8, we know we're going to get that argument that was passed. And if we pass 2 arguments or 3 arguments, we can say EBP plus 12, EBP plus 16, and that's how we're able to access the arguments that were passed to this called function or subroutine. In 64-bit, it may be this way, but it may not. It could be in the registers as well. It could say something like, go and get that argument from R8 or R9. But that should explain how the base pointer is used. The stack pointer currently also points at a save frame pointer, but look what we're about to do. Subtract hex 20 from the address held in the stack pointer. That means we're allocating a 32-byte buffer, because hex 20 is 32 bytes. The stack pointer now points to the top of the stack for this function's stack frame, and that'd be buffer space. So say, for example, if we call stir copy right now, string copy, and we say the destination as to where to write the data with stir copy is in this stack buffer. Well, we'd be writing it into that buffer that was just allocated, and we give it that address as the argument for, again, the destination to write. So now that we've got the stack frame set up, we've allocated buffer space, what would happen at this point is function X's code would run. Whatever function X was called to do, we've set up its stack frame, and now it gets to do what it's supposed to do. When it's done executing its code, it's going to hit the code known as the procedure epilogue at the bottom. So if we move on to that, look what just happened. We copied the address held in the base pointer into the stack pointer. We've now deallocated the stack buffer that was created earlier on. And notice it says old data on the right. It's still there unless we memset it, but it's not needed anymore. The stack pointer always points to the top of the stack. So clearly that old data is no longer needed, but it's still there. just in case you wanted to know. So that would be the first step of the procedure epilogue. Then next, we're doing this POP EBP. POP is a powerful instruction. Just like push pushes something onto the stack and the stack pointer adjusts accordingly, it points to it. The POP instruction pops whatever the stack pointer is pointing to off of the stack into the designated register, and then the stack pointer would move down accordingly. So in this case, we've popped off the stack the saved frame pointer, and we've restored the base pointer to where it pointed prior to this function call. If you remember in the procedure prologue, we pushed EBP to produce a saved frame pointer, and then we copied the stack pointer into the base pointer and we moved it away. Now we're restoring it. We're popping the saved frame pointer off the stack into the base pointer, and the base pointer is now restored. And finally, we get here to the ret instruction, which is an extremely powerful instruction. The ret instruction says whatever address the stack pointer is pointing to, not whatever address is held in the stack pointer register. We're saying whatever the stack pointer register is pointing to, what's stored at that address, return control to that address. That means that the instruction pointer is now going to redirect execution to whatever the return pointer is. In this case, restoring it back to the main function where we left off prior to the call. So you'll hear people incorrectly say, I'm overwriting EIP or overwriting RIP. That's not true. You can't overwrite a register. You can redirect execution using an instruction that's capable of doing that, but you're overwriting a return pointer or some function pointer that's allowing you to gain control of the instruction pointer. You're not overwriting the instruction pointer. So now that we've restored everything, we're returning control to the caller. All should be good. But notice what the stack pointer is pointing to now. The stack pointer points to that old argument that we pushed onto the stack prior to the function call to function X. We don't want the stack pointer pointing there anymore because that's old data. So something called the calling convention that you select at compile time is going to determine how we clean up the stack. Now, again, why is the stack pointer pointing there? Because we just did a ret instruction and we return to the return pointer. That's what the stack pointer does. It just advances to the next double or quad word, depending on the architecture, on the stack. Well, right now it's pointing to an old argument, and we don't want it to. We could clean this up a couple of ways, depending on the calling convention. The example on the bottom left there, we're saying ret 4. That means return to the return pointer like you were supposed to, but advance the stack pointer 4 more bytes than you normally would have. If we just do a ret, it's just going to advance to the next double or quad word. If we do a ret 4, it says skip the next 4 bytes and advance further. If there were two arguments, we could do a ret 8 or a ret 16. And that's one way of cleaning up the stack. The other way we could do it is look over to the left where the instruction pointer is pointing right now. It says XOR EAX EAX. We could do it as well where we say add 4 bytes to the stack pointer, or add 8 bytes to the stack pointer. And that would accomplish the same goal as like a ret 4 or a ret 8. And again, it depends on the calling convention. Speaking of calling conventions, we've got two listed here. There are more than these two, but these are very common. CDECL and standard call. They define how we receive and return data in regard to function calls, how parameters will be placed onto the stack and the order. So both CDECL and standard call, the parameters or arguments are placed from right to left. In CDECL, the caller tears down the stack. So if we go back a slide and you look at this example in the very bottom, it says ret 4. Is that CDECL or is that standard call? Well, if we look at CDECL, it says the caller tears down the stack. So no, that example would not be CDECL. In standard call, it says the called function is responsible for tearing down the stack. In this case, here you see the called function is handling the cleanup. If we return back to the caller in main and it said add 4 to ESP, that would be an example of CDECL. So it's determining who cleans up the stack. I joke and say that one's more polite than the other. My analogy would be if someone cooks you dinner, that would be nice of you then to clean up the dishes, right? So would that be CDECL or standard call? C-Deckel says the caller tears down the stack. So it's being more polite. It's saying, hey, you know, I called you to do something for me, so I'll handle cleaning up the stack. As where standard call is a little bit more rude and says, I called you to do something for me, and I expect you to clean up as well. So not only cook the food, also clean up the dishes. Just a silly analogy. So that would be how the stack operates. The debugger that we're going to use a lot in this book is the GNU debugger. Now, on the 64-bit Kali image that you'll use for some of the section, a plugin called PETA is there, and that stands for Python Exploitation Development something. We'll get to it soon. But it's a plugin that was written to kind of make a very command line driven debugger look a little bit more graphical or a little bit more visual. And it comes with some additional commands that GDB doesn't natively come with that are useful for exploit development. So we'll be using that when we get to the Kali section with that 64-bit Stack Overflow. But for a lot of this, we're just going to use 32-bit GDB. We're going to use GDB that does not have the plugin. And it's not because I want to torture anyone. It's because you'll learn more because you're going to have to go and look for things. And I recommend writing things down as you're doing them. So if you think the stack pointer is supposed to point here, or if you think the return pointer is supposed to be there, and you write this stuff down, it's a better learning experience. And then you can go on to moving these plugins and such. There's also other versions like EDB or DDD. There's a bunch of them out there that you can try experimenting with. But for the first part, we're just going to use native GDB. And I'll do a comparison. When you use Vim or Vi for the first time, the command line editor or whatever you want to call it, it's not intuitive, right? People get stuck in it. It's not intuitive to type escape colon Q bang or something like that. You have to learn that. But once you get past the learning curve, you see how powerful the Vim really is, and you end up using that more. Same thing with GDB. It's not very intuitive at first, but once you learn its power, it becomes second nature and it's very easy to use. But expect that bit of learning curve. There's a cheat sheet on your course USB, and there's also lots of cheat sheets online. So the GNU debugger supports C, C++, and Fortran. We're not going to do any Fortran debugging today. I'm sorry if you wanted to do that. But we'll do C primarily today. And we're going to attach to a process. We're going to open processes. It allows you to examine the registers, look at the disassembly. You get the context of what's going on at any moment in time in a process. And you can set breakpoints to pause execution based on a condition or a memory address being reached and lots more.